Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Committee on Judiciary for the Senate. And we have a pretty full schedule today. And so we're going to do a couple of bills possibly out of order. In fact, we will do them out of order. But before we do that, we have possible measures for an introduction. So the chair is going to read these four that are potential for committee bills: LC 2914, LC 2794, LC 2904, and LC 3349. And the chair will take a motion for those as committee bills.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 2914, LC 3349, LC 2904, and LC 2794 be adopted as committee bills.
Senator Bolognese moves those four LCs that are on the record as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And what we're going to do is we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 354.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 354 requires an auto insurer to provide written disclosure on all settlement documents stating the agreement forecloses additional benefits under the policy, requires notice of the option to rescind settlement agreement within 14 days from signing, and requires a witness signature for a valid settlement agreement. There is no amendment on this bill. We don't have a fiscal, and we has no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Metzger, I see that you're here, and so I want to ask you to come up. And is there other people you'd like to bring with you?
Lindy.
Okay, so Lindy's the only one that I have listed here, so that's wonderful. And when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Senate Bill 354 is simply about consumer protection. It's simple. It's straightforward. It will help to ensure that consumers are protected during the conclusion of a settlement following a motor vehicle accident. There's three major components to the bill. First, it requires a clear written disclosure on all settlement documents, notifying the insured that upon signing the settlement, no additional benefits will be paid. This makes perfect logical sense. It should be clearly stated on all forms that the consumer's signature allows for the conclusion of the settlement and no additional benefits will be paid. The consumer should clearly see that signing that settlement closes their claim. Second, SB 354 requires a witness present when the settlement is signed. Having one present protects all parties involved. It is one additional safeguard to protect the consumer of any potential over persuasion to sign a settlement that may not be in their best interest. And finally, SB 354 also allows for a 2-week, 14-day period in which the consumer can rescind the settlement by written notice. We believe the 14-day potential rescind period still allows for quick settlements when necessary, but also gives the consumer the ability to take time away from the potential pressure of an insurance representative to fully understand the ramifications of signing their settlement. It also gives them the ability to seek counsel, should they need to, within that time, to discuss the settlement. That is really the heart of this measure. I will tell you there's a measure in the House side, 2369, that deals with this and actually deals with the different coverages and PIP limitations and subrogation and maybe some things you want to consider. But this one is pretty narrow. It's just making sure that people know that when they sign something, when they're being pressured to sign, that they need to know that they are limiting their options. And Lindy is here to give her story, who brought this bill to my office, about why this is important.
Hello, my name is Lindy Minton. Thank you for hearing me today. I was involved in a serious car accident. Initially, it was impossible to know what my injuries were. You're in shock. Everything hurts. I suffered significant whiplash, some pulled muscles, ligaments, suffered a knee injury, and I'm still under physician's care. I've always considered myself pretty tough. I'm a farm girl. I've been run over by cows. I've taken a few dives off horses, and I figured, you know, this is just another one of those days. I'd lick my wounds, and I would be fine, and I could move on. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. A week after my car accident, the adjuster from the company that was responsible for the incident came to my home to look at my car. I was hoping at that time that he would allow us to repair the car rather than total the car, as our insurance company had determined that it was a total, because I couldn't deal with the thought of looking for a vehicle at that time. I had just had a CAT scan for a concussion. I was very achy. I felt like I had the flu. Just ill. I explained this to him. And I also explained that my biggest concern was I live on a farm. We have cattle, we have horses, we have children, we have a 50-tree orchard, a huge garden, and it's my job. I stay home with my family, and that's what I do. And that it's June, the busiest time of my year, and my focus was just to get better as quickly as possible. He seemed like such a nice guy, and it completely disarmed me. He said, Mrs. Minton, we just want to help you. We know that this is a huge inconvenience to you. I can offer you $500 to hire somebody to come in and help you with your farm work. And I said, oh, no, you know, I mean, who would I hire? And then I was kind of feeling a little wimpy, you know, like I was whining. And he said, well, you know, you can use it for paying out of pocket for your medical expenses until they come in. And I said, no, I have health insurance, and, you know, I don't anticipate a lot of medical expense. Well, Mrs. Minton, we just want to help. I can offer you $750, and you can use it for anything. And the alarms hadn't gone off yet. And I said, well, you know, that's okay. You know, it's not. No, you can use it for anything you'd like. And very quietly he said, and it would release my client of any further liability. I just got done telling him that I had a concussion, that I had a 24/7 headache, that my doctor anticipated would last for over a month, that I was having a really hard time coping, and here he is trying to make settlement in my home with me on my bodily injury claim. Needless to say, once the light came on, I was not a happy camper. I explained to him that I thought that it should be illegal, and if it wasn't, it was certainly immoral, to which his reply was, it's not illegal. So then I asked him, who would pay for my medical expenses if I signed? His reply was, my PIP would. And I said, why would my PIP pay if I've released liability? They couldn't subrogate. They couldn't be reimbursed. And his response was, well, then your health insurance company would have to. My health insurance company, why would they have to pay for this? And he said, well, it's a law. And of course, I didn't believe him because it didn't seem right. So I gave him a good butt-chewing, explained to him that, you know, I actually said, what, do you go to the hospital and offer somebody a pizza to sign off on their medical liability? I was outraged. He basically said, well, it was my decision to accept it or decline it, and basically it was no skin off his nose either way. So I went to my health insurance company and indeed found out that it was true. When you sign off on your PIP or when it's expended, then it falls under your health insurance company, and they're not all too happy about this loop in the law. My PIP carrier on Monday, 2 days after he came, had sent a letter to me that basically warned me not to sign anything. So I thought maybe it's a gesture. So I contacted Progressive, explained the situation, and they said, you must have misunderstood. I contacted the insurance commissioner's office and found out also there is no law against it. I hopped on the internet and found that this happens a lot. It's called a quick claim settlement. Their goal is between 24 and 72 hours after an accident to get to you as quickly as they can to have you sign off on your medical liability before you know what your injuries are. Several states have passed legislation to prevent this abuse. Typically, those most affected are the elderly, minorities, and young adults. $500 to a young adult seems like a lot of money when you just have a headache, and you figure you're invincible. You're going to be fine. He didn't appear as an adjuster would appear. It was more like a sales job. He was very smooth. There is no downside to this legislation. It will benefit the health insurance companies, reputable auto insurance companies. The auto insurance companies don't like this either because basically it puts into question whether they still have to pay under their PIP benefits for a third-party liability. It will also help our Oregon health plan and Medicaid and Medicare because once people sign, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not done receiving treatment. I hope that makes sense.
It does.
And basically what we're asking for is clear disclosure, easily understood by the average consumer. Some of the things that they've sent me, I mean, I have to read 3 and 4 times to understand what they're trying to essentially do. But the predatory quitclaim settlements, I believe, are immoral, and they really should be illegal. So I ask that you give your full support to this bill.
All right, thank you. Let me ask if there's any questions for either our panelists. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming forward. I have no one else that's currently scheduled or wanting to give testimony on Senate Bill 354. If there is anyone who wants to give testimony, please step forward. Not seeing anyone, we'll close
that.
Oh, John, you got to be quicker than that. The gavel's almost going down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Come on up.
John Powell, before you represent State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the story that you just heard is obviously very troubling and something that the insurance industry as a whole would not support and hopefully would not act that way. There is a bill that Senator Metzger mentioned to you that's being worked by the House Consumer Committee that is, I think its next stop in the process will be a work session. And in that bill, we address this type of an issue by allowing PIP subrogation for up to 60 days after an accident, so that the PIP, if there is a settlement, notwithstanding a settlement, the subrogation be allowed. The effect of that being a person who settles to get the needed money for their replacement of their automobile is not foregoing their ability to come back and get medical claims resolved.
So, John, let me just make sure. What Senator Metzger said, if we got that correct, is House Bill 2369?
Yes.
And is that a bill that you would think the industry on a broader basis would be more supportive because it goes into more greater detail and options as compared to this bill that's before us?
Mr. Chair, I don't sense it has greater detail. This bill has more detail to it, the witness to the signature and that sort of thing. The House bill is a broader protection that we have negotiated with some medical providers and fully support. So I would not say it's more detailed than this bill, but I think it addresses the issue that this bill brings before you.
Okay. Did you have any other comments?
Chair Prezidansky, members of the committee, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. I'm just kind of here if you had questions about 2369 and how it works at all.
Since 2369 is not before the committee, I'd prefer to hold off. Sounds like y'all are working it, and it sounds like it's going to be coming this way. Since I have the chair of the Consumer Protection Committee next to me, we're kind of figuring that one of the two of us will be getting that bill. So I think what I want to do at this point is appreciate one of your statements that are on the record. Is anyone that had any questions?
I just have a quick question. John and Steve, do you get a sense, you listen to the story, and there's a handout here that doesn't have a name on it, but it has some excerpts from some articles and blogs. Do you get a sense that this practice is being done by one particular company and the rest of the industry is shunning it, or is it something that's a little bit more widespread?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonamici, I'll let Mr. Merle answer that question since he has a lot of experience in handling claims and reviewing them with other companies that State Farm would interact with.
Chair Prezidansky, members of the committee, again, and for the record, my name is Steve Merle of State Farm Insurance. I am not completely versed in whether companies do. I know that early settlements do occur. I know that in my company, if we do have one where it's an early on settlement, it's typically not going to be where we're at your home. Just to how we're structured, we're probably going to talk to you on the phone, mail a release to you, so maybe have some cooling off there that you didn't hear in the story that you're talking about here. Also, if we're talking to someone in the situation that this lady was in, where she obviously has ongoing problems, we would not consider that an appropriate candidate for early settlement. Early settlement with us is something where maybe you have a bump, soreness the day after, and by the time we're talking to you, it's resolved. And that would be the time where we'd do that within the first 60 days, and other than that, we typically would not feel it was an appropriate type of settlement.
Thank you.
All right, and looking at what's on this page, it sounds like Progressive is the insurance company that, let's say, identified. I actually know of a constituent that's had a similar situation basically where there's a complete denial of any liability on the part of the driver that was insured by that insurance company, where that driver actually had violated a traffic law. Not saying that there wasn't a fault on the other side as well, but it seems like they're aggressive as well as maybe progressive. So let me do this. We're going to close this one out at this point, and we'll wait to see if the other bill, House Bill 2369, makes it to our committee. And I guess the last thing I will say is for Lindy, thank you very much for coming forward. And it would have been quite interesting if you had signed that, then how they would have wanted to defend themselves, even though you told them that you were suffering from a concussion, as to whether or not that would have stayed open. But I'm glad that you didn't. I'm glad that you brought this before us. And I expect that we'll see the other bill, and hopefully between the two chambers, we'll get something worked out. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 354. And Council, do we want to go back up to the top at this point? I don't see Representative Olson here yet.
We'll make sure we call his office.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and go up to the top of the agenda, Senate Bill 306. We'll open a public hearing. And Council, if you'll give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 306 increases the demand limit of small tort actions from $5,500 to $10,000. There are several amendments on this bill. I think we have four as of today that I know about. At this point, we don't have a revenue impact or fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. I have Neil Jackson, James Nelson, and Erica Glasser in the support area. Then also, is it Tang or Thang? Thang Tinson?
He's on the dash twos.
On the dash two. Okay. Why don't you stay there? Y'all three come on up, and we'll get the stuff going on the record, then we'll come back.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in support of Senate Bill 306. I've had the opportunity to talk to all the members of the committee about this bill, but I just want to recap quickly what it's about. The last time the limit of $5,500 was raised was back in 2000 or 2001. Prior to that, it was $4,000. This bill actually goes all the way back to the 50s. In the 50s, the legislature decided that people who either suffer property damage or some kind of damage needed some way that they could put some pressure on insurance companies to pay attention to them. And back in the 50s, they passed the first bill, 20080, which set the limit at $500. It's been raised to $5,500 up to this point. We're asking that it be raised to $10,000. One of the problems that we're dealing with at this point, aside from inflation and all the other factors, is that consumers are now being forced to reduce their claims to $5,500 in order to get representation. I can tell the committee that the insurance companies do pay attention. When they get a 10-day demand letter, they pay attention to it and they jump right on it. And that is the purpose of the statute. Our Supreme Court, in the case of Bivens versus Unger, said ORS 20080 is a statute designed to deal with a particular evil, the frequent rejection by tortfeasors and their insurers of small claims, knowing that the claimant would often consider it impractical to bring an action if he had to pay his own attorney's fees. That is the purpose of the statute. It is coercive, there's no doubt about it. But the purpose is that when the consumer or their attorney sends that 10-day demand letter, the insurance company must pay attention to it because the risk is greater. If I have a client that has an $8,000 claim and they come to me and it's a tort claim, whether it be property damage or whatever, I have to tell them, I'm sorry, but it is not practical and it is not in your interest to bring that $8,000 claim. We must reduce it to $5,500 because that is the only way that I can tell you that you will get at least $5,500. You won't get $8,000 because I got to be paid, I have a mortgage, I will have to take a fee out of the $8,000, and they will get less than $5,500. What we're asking is that we raise the threshold from $5,500 to $10,000, which will allow, by the way, the purpose of this is to get these claims settled. And when the companies pay attention to these claims, because they do get the 10-day letter, most of these cases settle. They don't go to litigation. They shouldn't go to litigation. They should get the attention of the insurers, and they should pay attention and try and get them resolved in a fair manner. I'm going to quit now, but I do want to address the amendments because I've had the opportunity to see them all. Senator Bonamici's amendment, the Dash 2 amendment, we are in favor of it. It makes perfect sense because 2008-2 is the statute right after 080, and what it does is it provides for small contract cases to also allow for attorney's fees. Mr. Tyson is here. He'll explain that to you and tell you about his cases he's had. We absolutely oppose Dash 1. Dash 1 guts 2080. It literally guts it. Instead of being $5,500, if the Dash 1 is passed, you could have a claim cut down to $500. And that's just the way it works. I won't go into detail, but I'll tell you, it guts 2080. The Dash 4 amendment is clearly put in to reverse a case that just came down from the Supreme Court called Powers versus Quigley. In that case, the Supreme Court said, look, 2080 stands alone. Once you don't pay within the 10 days, if a suit is filed, you are on the hook for attorney's fees, so you had better pay attention to it and try and get it settled before. As far as the Dash 3 amendment goes, I will tell the committee that yesterday I started talking to my friends on the insurance industry side. We're going to be talking. There are some concerns that they have that need to be addressed. They are legitimate concerns, and I'm aware of them. We've talked about them before, and I'm going to talk to my friends on the other side and see if we can address those concerns, too. Thank you.
All right, so on the Dash 3s, that's something that you're saying yourself, as well as others that are opposing, let's say, 306 at this point, are looking at as modifying?
Yes, as a part of a comprehensive modification.
Gotcha. All right, who wants to go next?
Thank you, Chairperson and Senators, for allowing me to speak. My name is Erica Glazer, and I apologize that my brief summary wasn't sent to you in time. I started my career as a trial attorney, and then I left the plaintiff's side for 7 years to work in-house counsel for Farmers Insurance. And in that capacity, I tried many, many cases. As an in-house counsel attorney, I was paid a salary, so it wasn't ever a risk to Farmers to send me to trial because they weren't paying me an hourly rate as they would to outside counsel. But I must say, the reason why Oregon Trial Lawyers Association asked me to come here and speak today is that we definitely had to pay more attention to 10-day demand letters that came with an ORS 20.080 because there was the risk of attorney fees being awarded in addition if we were not to beat the offer at trial. So it really is an incentive. And the reason why I support it is that $5,500 just isn't enough today to cover small claims. A small claim really is $10,000 or less. And I know in the past I think there was a push to make it $7,500 or less, but I think just given what things cost today, $10,000 or less is a good measure. And I've been a plaintiff's attorney for the past 4 years, and now I've seen this on the other side, and I just support the bill.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the chair for Zansky and the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak. I'm James Nelson. I've been practicing in a small firm in Albany, Oregon for about 32 years. I currently represent everyday average citizens similar to those that be in your districts. For 12 years, however, my primary practice was insurance defense. I represented one of the largest insurance companies in America, dozens of other smaller companies. I represented self-insured corporations such as retailers and food chains, defending tort claims and property damage claims. I can tell you, based upon my 32 years of experience, this statute works, and it's been working since the 1950s. It focuses the attention of corporations and insurance companies on the settlement of the smaller claims. And I can tell you statistically, most claims are small claims. Most of your constituents, when they're in an accident or have a claim, it's going to be a smaller claim. It focuses everybody's attention. The statute deters somebody from being too aggressive or greedy in presenting a claim because there's a penalty for that. It also encourages those that are in charge of settling claims to pay attention because it could get much more costly if they're not reasonable.
Unfortunately, in the insurance industry, it's very hard for them to raise their rates. It's very easy for insurance companies to scrimp on claims because that's not regulated like rates are. And unfortunately, that's a problem that is reoccurring. So this statute reduces litigation. It's done it for decades. And reducing civil litigation is a major concern these days. The cost of litigation is great. The criminal docket, due primarily to the drug problem in many counties, is pushing the civil cases down the docket. They're not even getting trial dates, and it's a substantial problem. So this really is an update of a very effective, long-standing consumer bill that is an advantage both for the insurance companies and for the claimants in the long run. The dollar amount is probably a little bit more, but not much more, than the cost of living from the last time that the limits were raised on this. But when you're dealing with this type of claim, you're dealing with future medical bills, property damage, repair to vehicles, costs that have accelerated much faster than the cost of living. I think medical cost has escalated at probably 2 to 3 times the cost of living. So basically, this is an update, financial update of a very successful bill that's been working at its purpose for decades, and we're just simply bringing it up to date. So we'll continue to reduce litigation, get the smaller claims settled, and provide a service to the Oregonians that need this. And it also provides a service to the insurance companies by focusing their attention. It avoids litigation for them. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Take any questions.
Yeah. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Next, I'm going to ask Thang, why don't you come on up by yourself, since you're the only other one we have listed in four. I understand your comments are going to be limited to the dash twos.
Yes, Chair Przanski, good morning. I'm Thane Jensen. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and like Mr. Nelson, I too have been practicing 32 years, and like him as well, I spent the first half of my career as a defense lawyer, but it was my experience in particular in the last couple of years in representing people with relatively small civil claims who were forced to make a decision, as has been pointed out, to either accept to reduce their claims to $5,500 or abandon them altogether, to speak to my senator, Senator Bonamici, and ask her to introduce some legislation that would increase this to $10,000. And I'm speaking on behalf of this. Now, let me tell you a couple incidents that in particular sparked my motivation in doing this. These are all within the last year. People come to me. Two of them were contract actions. One of them was a small landscape nursery people in Clatsop County, where I grew up, that had a $9,200 contract action. Did some work and simply were not paid. The person claimed that he was in financial straits. Gee, there was some work you did that was defective. It seemed like it was a legitimate claim. I spoke to the customer, and they were very happy with it. But there was no attorney's fee provision in this contract. So as a practical matter, what do? And there's a lot of detail involved, and gee, how did this, the work that was done. And I told him just matter-of-factly, either you end up having to reduce your claim to $5,500, or you go forward and seek the full $9,200 that you want, recognizing that at the end of the day, even with a reduced fee, which I'm perfectly willing to do, and in fact do frequently and a lot of pro bono work, but even with that, you're going to end up in all likelihood with a lesser amount than you would if you reduced your claim to $5,500. It's not fair. Second claim, another contract action. A friend of mine who's an engineer, $8,500 contract, similar situation, didn't get paid, no attorney's fee provision in the contract, handshake deal, and told him the same thing. Essentially, you're forced to reduce your claim to $5,500 or end up in a situation where at the end of the day you find yourself with even less amount by going forward on a straight attorney's fee basis. On the tort side, a fellow who was in a boating accident, sideswiped by a barge, a tidewater barge, $7,500 damage to the boat, some very minor injuries. And again, similar situation. They dispute liability. They say, no, you came within our wake, even though I had a Coast Guard report that placed full responsibility on the barge. He was in a situation where he either had to reduce his claim to $5,500 or and go forward recognizing that he would end up at the end of the day with less money. And then another person who was an uninsured motorist with a new expensive car, $8,100 damage, similar situation, disputed liability. And they're all in the same situation where they've basically been forced to accept unfair low settlements or abandon their claims altogether, all because the amount set forth in these statutes is limited to $5,500. And I have practiced in Washington State for 26 years. The reason I mention that is Washington, for 25 of those years, has had a $10,000 ceiling on its small claims, civil claims bill. And these same insurance companies that are griping about this one deal with Vancouver, Washington, Clark County. They're probably adjusting in that same area, and they've been dealing with it for 25 years without incident. As a practical matter, the cost of living, I looked at this, so both the Consumer Price Index, Social Security adjustments have gone up. I think Consumer Price Index, 220% since 1984, when the $4,000 limit was instituted in 2008. So even applying that, you're at $8,800. And the cost of living adjustments is a little bit less, but not much, 207%, something like that, in Social Security. So you're looking, as a practical matter, at about the same time, just simply by looking at the cost of inflation. So I strongly urge that this committee urge passage of the amendment to increase the small claims amount for both contract and tort actions to $10,000.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call Tom Kranovich and Steve Merle up.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I'm Tom Kranovich.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm told that I'm supposed to give you a little bit of background information, and since I'm a lawyer blowing my own horn, actually, it's not going to bother me at all, but I'm currently the principal of a two-person insurance defense firm, Kranovich and Lucero. I've been a litigator since 1982. Before that, I clerked in circuit court for 3 years. I've had an insurance defense practice since 1988. I worked in-house for a company that no longer exists, having been eaten by a larger company in recent months, and managed their legal department for a number of years. I returned to private practice in 2002. The focus of my practice is insurance defense and representing public bodies that are self-insured and their insurance is managed through a self-insurance pool. I am a Clackamas County Pro Tem Circuit Court judge. I sit on the motion docket, and I sit on almost all of their small claims actions that have been filed in Clackamas County for the last 5 years. I've been an arbitrator for 15 years. I'm past president of the Clackamas County Bar Association, member of the Oregon State Bar House of Delegates, and a recipient of two Oregon State Bar President's Awards. I'm here today to speak against 20080. I was here back in 2000-2001, and heard many of these same arguments being made then, and when it was increased from 4,000 to 5,500. There's one thing that I think I need to point out, because it was mentioned earlier about the purpose of 2080, and it was to encourage and prevent insurance companies and tortfeasors from refusing to pay just claims. That's only part of the quote that comes from the court, however. I cite to you a quote from Fresh versus Kramer, and that's 337 Oregon 513, a 2004 case, which it says that the purpose of this statute is to encourage settlement of small claims to prevent insurance companies and tortfeasors from refusing to pay just claims and to discourage plaintiffs from inflating their claims. And that's the flip side of any 2080 claim, and any 2080 increase that always has to be looked at is, will it encourage the inflation of claims? The current law has always bothered me because it does not require any documentation or substantiation of any kind of claim. The statute specifically says all it takes is a demand for payment. Pay me $4,000, $5,500, whatever the limit is, that's all it takes. And if you don't pay it in 10 days, then you are subject to attorney fees. Even if documentation is provided, 10 days is often enough time to evaluate a claim. I would remind the committee that until and unless a lawsuit is filed in a third-party claim, there is no discovery. You cannot take a deposition of the claimant. You cannot serve a request for production of documents on the claimant. None of that can happen until after the lawsuit is filed. And even if documentation is presented, it does not mean that further investigation along the way will not reveal alternate explanations for the claim, i.e. previous injury or damage or subsequent injury or damage. I would remind the committee that carriers represent insureds in a third-party setting. Often the only information a carrier has to go on is the information provided by its insured. And as you have undoubtedly heard in other instances, insureds will come in and they will tell you, my carrier is obligated to believe me until and unless there's evidence contrary. And again, that 10 days really limits the amount of time in which you can investigate and make a decision. In the area of public bodies, as I indicated, most of them are self-insured, and they are managed through self-insurance pools. In the instance of public bodies, you're not talking about insurance company money, you're talking about taxpayer dollars, which the public body is obligated to try to protect. And again, I believe 2080 puts an unreasonable demand on those public bodies to investigate and deal with those claims in a meaningful manner and thus protect those taxpayer funds. The attorney fee provision in 2080 only cuts one way. I'm sure you all know this, but last time I was here, it actually surprised a member of this committee to learn that. There was mention made about Washington. I would remind the committee that, as I understand it, I'm not a member of the Washington Bar, but Washington is loser pay. If the defendant loses, they pay. If the plaintiff loses, they pay attorney fees. Oregon does not have such a scheme, and especially in 2080. If a carrier gets a defense verdict, or gets a verdict that is less than the amount the carrier offered, the only benefit the carrier obtains from that is they don't have to pay the other side's attorney fees. It's been mentioned that attorney fees cannot be cut off by confessions of judgment via a recent Supreme Court case. I'm assuming the amendments will take care of that. That really does get in the way. I would also remind you that all 2080 cases are subject by their jurisdictional limits to mandatory arbitration. There isn't a county in the state that has arbitration for under $50,000. We're not talking about anything that's going to have a significant impact on the judicial system and get in the way of their ability to try all those meth users. These cases get resolved
via arbitration if they don't otherwise be resolved.
And so on. Further, I think that the committee did a wise thing when they raised the small claims limits to $7,500. That does give people recourse to have their claim heard up to $7,500 without even the necessity of going to a lawyer. And the additional side to that is that the other side, whoever's defending, they can't haul a lawyer in either. I can't speak for other small claims courts, but in Clackamas County, as one of my colleagues back here just reminded me, I don't let lawyers come into my court. He reminded me that I didn't let him come into my court. Silly me, but that's the purpose of small claims courts, keep the darn lawyers out of there and get these cases resolved quickly and efficiently. It is not unusual, in my experience, for attorneys to seek amounts of $300 an hour. It is not unusual, in my experience, as a judge sitting on the motion panel in Clackamas County, to award attorney fees of $300 an hour. If you call expert witnesses, they will tell you $300 an hour is reasonable for an experienced trial lawyer. It's not unusual in a $4,000 case to pay attorney fees in excess of $16,000. And in recent months, it has been my experience that in every instance in 2080, if we lose, then somebody comes forward and seeks enhanced costs pursuant to 20.190 in the amount of $5,000. The argument being is that since we're entitled to attorney fees, this whole thing was so egregious, I'm automatically entitled to $5,000 enhanced costs under 20.190. And lastly, it's not unusual for me to see, having the same argument propounded, a multiplier, a lodestar, seeking 1.5 to 2.0 the times the amount of attorney fees the attorney has sought. So in the $16,000 attorney fee claim, it's not unusual for me to have to defend a claim for $32,000 plus $5,000 additional costs. And in order to meet my obligations to my client, I have to go out and hire an expert witness to come in and testify at the attorney fee hearing why the lodestar isn't appropriate and why the enhanced prevailing party fee is not appropriate. This in and of itself drives up the time and the cost of litigation. With the cost and fees of mandatory arbitration, the risk of appealing an arbitration award and seeking a trial de novo are so prohibitive that it impedes a defendant's ability to have a trial by jury. And I submit that that's a concept that's fundamentally flawed. The current scheme of attorney fees under 2080 has a significant chilling effect on whether or not a defendant's insurance company can afford to allow their insured to have his day in court. The potential for attorney fees is such that carriers defend at their own peril. I submit that the judiciary and legislature need to find ways to reduce the time and cost of getting civil cases resolved without unfairly penalizing either side and without creating an undue burden on the defendant's right to have a jury trial. 2080 was designed to prevent carriers from refusing to pay just claims and to discourage plaintiffs from inflating their claims. This increase of the jurisdictional limit over time encourages inflated claims without documentation as part of the demand.
Tom, I'm going to need you to wrap up.
Very briefly, thank you. I submit it's time that we find a solution other than putting money in the hands of attorneys to get this resolved. We need to look at carriers and decide in the analysis whether or not to award attorney fees. It should be determined by what the carrier knew, when the carrier knew, and what the carrier did once it knew it. If we do anything else, it can lead to unilateral legalized extortion, and I don't think that's what anybody wants. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and I apologize for taking too much time.
That's fine. And let's take Steve's testimony, and then we'll open up for the panel.
Chairperson Ski, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Steve Myrtle with State Farm Insurance, and I know we do have a lot of people wanting to talk on this bill. I primarily want to just echo there are a lot of abuses with this unlevel playing field. We have instances where attorneys will make demands, give us no information about the claim, and tell us they're not going to give us any more information about the claim. We have instances where attorneys will send the demand to our insured, knowing it'll take some days for the insured to finally get it to the insurer and thereby cut down the amount of time we had to respond. There's one reported case in the appellate reports that of an attorney who made a demand for $5,500, filed a suit for $25,000, and the carrier defended it like it was a $25,000 suit. On the day of trial, he amended his complaint downward to $5,500, was allowed to do so by the trial judge, and did get attorney's fees. Those are just some of the abuses. I could tell you more, but I don't want to take more of your time. I am the one who asked to have the -1 amendments drafted. I think they address a lot of the issues that are problems with the statute. State Farm does not favor going forward with an amendment to the statute, but we feel like if you do, there are a lot of problems that need to be fixed. Conceptually, what we are trying to do with the -1 amendments is to make sure that the claims that are for $10,000. It is a game that the plaintiff's bar plays to see if you'll get their client's car repaired, and then they'll sue you about something to do with that car after they're done. They'll sue you for the difference. Maybe you've already paid $12,000 for the repair, but they're making another $5,000 additional claim, and they're doing it under this statute and getting attorney's fees. I don't think that's fair. I think it should truly be the amount that the threshold is set at. The other thing that we're suggesting in -1 is to make the attorney fee award discretionary. Conceptually, the reason to make it discretionary is to allow the court to evaluate, did the parties try to settle this, and gauge the attorney fee and award attorney fees based on the parties' attempts to settle pre-litigation and during litigation. That's all the comments I have. If you have questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. The last panel I have here is Ingrid Decker, Drake Hood, I believe, and Greg Lesby.
Good Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Decker with Tonkin Torp. I'm here this morning representing the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. OADC is a nonprofit organization comprised of nearly 700 trial attorneys who represent persons and companies in defense of civil actions. OADC's position on Senate Bill 306, as it's written, with respect to raising the cap from 5,500 to 10,000 is neutral. We're here this morning primarily to talk about the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments to the bill. The Dash 3 amendments were alluded to in earlier testimony, and essentially that amendment would increase the length of time which a defendant has to respond to a claim for payment before litigation is filed from 10 days to 30 days. And the Dash 3 amendment, or the Dash 4 amendment, applies Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 54E to ORS 20080, which is the statute that is the subject of Senate Bill 306. And I have with me this morning two attorneys who are members of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, Drake Hood and Greg Lusby, to testify specifically on these amendments and their impact on their day-to-day practice.
All right, that would be great if y'all could focus on that so we make sure we got another bill. Probably everyone signed up for that one, too, so I want to make sure we get all that testimony in.
Will do. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing us today. My name is Drake Hood. I'm the president-elect of the OADC. I'm a practitioner from Hillsboro, Oregon. I generally defend civil cases. I represent lawyers and doctors and hospitals and veterinarians, and I'm hired by insurance companies to defend their cases from time to time as well. What we're here about is not increasing the limit. As you've heard, what we'd like is to suggest a fairness in the process, and that one of those aspects would be to move this pre-filing timeline from 10 days to 30 days. I can tell you in the practice that I do, it's significant. When I represent veterinarians in questions of medical or veterinary malpractice, one of the things that the veterinarians and their carrier, if they have one, have to do is sort of evaluate and get an opinion from an expert. Did the veterinarian violate the standard of care here? I can tell you, that takes longer than 10 days. In terms of some of the testimony that you've heard about the amendments from Mr. Teensen and other members of the plaintiff's bar, they've generally told you, I think, that the process has worked, that this has been a statute that has worked for us in the past. And I would agree with that. This is the exception, and the reason for the Dash 4 amendment, where we're asking you to apply ORCP 54E if you make these changes. And that is, once a lawsuit is filed and a defense attorney gets involved, we're able to do discovery. If in that process we're able to gather some information that says, look, there may be a claim here, there may be some merit to this, but maybe it's not worth the $5,500,000, or maybe it's not worth the $10,000, based on what we think a jury might ultimately do or an arbitrator might award in the case, we may say to the client, look, we recommend that you settle this, but here's what the value is. Under the present law, given this case that was decided by the Supreme Court last fall, which changed the law that everybody had been dealing with, we're saying you're going to have to either pay $5,500 plus attorney's fees that have been generated to that point, or you're going to have to pay $10,000 if the amendment passes, and plus attorney's fees that have been generated to that point. So what we're asking you to do is say, go back to the old system that says, when you make an offer, and again, this has to be done 10 days in advance of the trial, so I would have to make an offer and say we'll pay $3,500, or we make an offer of $4,500. If the plaintiff fails to get more than $4,500 at the time of the arbitration or at the time of the trial, then they don't get their attorney's fees that are generated from that point forward. That's all that 54E amendment would do. This is an amendment that applies not just to insurance companies. I think you've heard it before that it applies to self-insureds as well. I represent those. Imagine tonight you go home and you receive in the mail a letter saying that your teenage son has been at a party a couple of weeks ago, got into a fight, and a claim's being made against you for an intentional tort. Your son beat somebody up. You now have 10 days to pay that, potentially up to $10,000, without any further information before going to going through the process of a lawsuit and potentially being held responsible yourself. Those are the kind of consequences that can't apply here. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. And Greg? All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel?
I have a quick question. Excuse me. I have a quick question for Mr. Hood about. I think this is under 54E. I just want to understand how this works. You said that when they make the offer 10 days before trial, and then if the plaintiff doesn't get that amount that was offered, then 54E says they don't get their attorney's fees from that point forward. And I just want to figure out which point you're talking about.
It's from the point that the offer is made.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right.
And that offer can be made at any point before 10 days. It's just you can't make it and have effect.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 306? Not seeing anyone. We'll close that public hearing. We're going to open a public hearing on the companion bill 309. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 309 allows introduction of medical bills as evidence of damages without being subject to a hearsay challenge or requiring authentication. It allows jury to award damages without testimony on the reasonableness or necessity of the medical expense. There is no amendment that I know of on this bill. There's no revenue impact. I do not have a fiscal statement on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Neil, if you'll come up and then... I think you're the only one that's as a proponent signed up, and then we'll bring up the next panel or two.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in support of Senate Bill 309. Again, I've had the opportunity to talk to members of the committee a little bit about this bill. What we're trying to do is sort of do what we've been doing since 1983. In 1983, the circuit court system, the court system in Oregon for civil cases instituted alternative dispute resolution, that is mandatory arbitration for all cases with a value or a prayer of $50,000 or less. It took us about a year to figure out how to do it. But by 1984, we all pretty much agreed, we being plaintiff side and defense side, that all you had to do in arbitration was to submit the medical bills that you had. And you submit those bills, the arbitrator then could make a decision. You did not have to bring a doctor in. You didn't have to bring a chiropractor in. You didn't have to bring the healthcare professional in with the incumbent costs. And that was the purpose of arbitration, to make litigation cheaper for both sides. We've been doing it. 84% of the cases are resolved by arbitration now, the civil cases. Those are the statistics from Judge Lamar in Multnomah County. I suspect it's that high in all the other counties. Since 1983, we haven't had to pay doctors to come in, take them out of their offices, and say, yes, I billed this amount, and yes, this is a reasonable amount, and these are treatments for the injuries to this person. This is not something that we concocted out of thin air. As the committee knows, because we've spoken, Arkansas has had this law since 1989, and I did have the opportunity to talk to a trial lawyer back there, and I've invited the people that have come to me about this bill to call Arkansas and talk to their people back there, because what I got when I talked to the fellow that I talked to is the plaintiff's attorneys like it, the defense attorneys like it, the doctors like it, the chiropractors like it, all the care providers like it, because you're not jerking these people out of their offices and making them go in and answer a silly question. Are your bills reasonable? Well, of course they're reasonable. That's how much I billed. And that's essentially what we're doing. Please understand that this bill does not change anything in terms of, if the defense wishes to challenge the reasonableness of the bill, the necessity of the bill, they can still do that. It doesn't stop them from doing that. All it does is, in most cases, and by the way, most cases, both sides stipulate to the bills. The defense gets all the bills because we give them to them. And they look at the bills, we look at the bills, we prepare a summary, we talk to each other and say, okay, this is the total I have, how much do you have? And then we talk about, okay, do you have a problem with any of these bills? If there's a problem, both sides are going to bring doctors in. If there's a dispute, both sides will bring doctors. This bill doesn't change that. All this bill does is say that if you've got, and it's particularly addressed to smaller cases, if you've got a smaller case, do you want to pay $2,500 to bring a doctor in to testify on a $7,500 case? No, you can't do it. This bill says on those smaller cases, you don't have to if you don't want it. And we've been doing it, like I said, we've been doing it since 83, and it's worked just fine. I have talked to a number of people about this bill, discussing concerns that they have had. I have talked to the chiropractors. They have no problem with it. I think the OMA is here, and it's my understanding we got one word, but other than that, they have no problem with it either. So,
all right. Questions?
Quick question, Mr. Chair. Neil, if you said usually there's a stipulation or you can do a request for admission, then what's left? It seems like what's left are the disputed bills, and you said that if they're disputed, then people bring somebody in anyway.
That is true. That is true. What's left are the situation. From my perspective, what's left is the situation in deference to the guys on the other side. Sometimes they use that as a lever. If you have a smaller case, and you know it's a smaller case, and so do they, sometimes they use that as a lever to try and force you to settle that case for less than it's worth, because they know you can't afford to pay $2,500 to bring that doctor in. And they use it as a lever, even though they know the bills are legit, but they know you've got to bring a doctor, because if you don't bring a doctor under present law, the jury doesn't even get to consider those bills. The judge will take it away from the jury. And so those bills are either their PIP carrier eats it, the health carrier eats it, or the client, if they have neither, they got to pay those bills, and they cannot recover those bills.
So the only thing I want to put on the record, counsel brought this to my attention, is that when you look at SB 309, it appears to would apply to any and all cases that are going through the court system, not to what I heard you say in your testimony in smaller cases. So
it does apply, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it does apply to all cases, but in reality, in practical reality, if you've got a bigger case, you're going to bring a doctor. You have to. It's the smaller cases where you can't afford to bring a doctor. And in addressing that also, Mr. Chairman, when we submitted that, we gave the Arkansas bill to LC, Legislative Council. What you have is they took it and expanded it and made it also applicable to administrative proceedings. I think that's probably appropriate, too. Workers' comp, my understanding, I don't do it, but my understanding is they currently don't have to bring the doctor in, but I understand they do it a lot.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and continue with testimony. It looks like we have this. I'm going to ask Drake to come back up and Greg. And then we'll do that, and I've got two others that will make up the next panel.
Good morning, members of the chair, or Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Greg Lusby. I practice down in Eugene at Arnold Gallagher. I'm here on behalf of OADC. I am a member of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, and OADC opposes this bill. The language is short in the bill. The bill size is small, but the reach of this bill is huge, with key elements of a traditional case, the medical expenses, the reasonableness of the medical expenses, and the necessity of those medical expenses, removing the burden of proof. And that's what we see is so problematic with this as written. It does remove the burden of proof on plaintiffs, on plaintiffs' counsel. It potentially opens up the potential, and as Mr. Chair pointed out, in a far-reaching number and type of cases, to basically walk in with a 2-3-time photocopied medical bill, lay it down, and it's conclusively accepted as being authentic, and the amount being sought is in. It is the established amount. And as the committee's already talked, there's three general requirements that we always expect in civil cases. The authenticity of the medical bill, the reasonableness of the medical bill, and the necessity of it related to the treatment. And I agree with the member of OTLA who just spoke. We generally work, especially in court annexed arbitration. Personally, I do not see many attorneys raising the issue that they didn't lay a proper foundation for that medical bill or that they needed to bring a doctor into court annexed arbitration. But again, this reaches all the way to the trial level, which is very problematic. Reasonable and necessary is what we argue. And yeah, we typically expect the treating physician to say my bills were reasonable, the treatment was necessary, but again, that's a question of fact, and it shifts the burden of proof. The word was it. The defense can challenge that. Well, that's shifting the burden of proof. And for that reason, we're opposed to this. Real quick, there are mechanisms for dealing with this. ORCP 45 requests for admissions. You send those to the defense counsel. You can give them the stack of medicals. Will you admit that these are authentic? Will you admit these medical bills are reasonable? Will you admit they're necessary? The defense can either admit it. If they fail to admit within 30 days, they are conclusively established. And under ORCP 46, if they are not admitted and the judge feels that it was unreasonable, the court has the option of awarding costs and attorney fees against the defending attorney. So for those reasons, we believe there's a mechanism here. We do not see the need for this bill. One curious word I did note in here was the word restitution is included in the bill, and as a former prosecutor, that is a term that we used in the criminal realm, but it's not a word that we use in the civil area. We, of course, talk of damages in civil cases. If the point of this is to allow restitution hearings in criminal cases to be easier on the victims, that arguably applies. That would apply under this bill. OADC doesn't take any kind of position with that, and if an exception wants to be carved out, I mean, clearly in crime victim restitution hearings, we shouldn't expect them to have to bring doctors in. But the bill as written is too broad, and again, it shifts the burden of proof and takes away the burden of proof that's well established.
Thank you. Drake?
Just a couple of points, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. As Mr. Jackson pointed out to you earlier, that since 1983, I think he said that we've had this arbitration process, at least in Multnomah County, it's statewide now. The number of times that I would see a doctor or a chiropractor or a medical professional called in to testify about medical bills is very small. Under the arbitration rules, plaintiff need only submit written documents, and that's frequently in the form of a letter from the plaintiff's attorney on the plaintiff's attorney's letterhead. Doctor, do you agree that the bills were this much, that they're reasonable, necessary, and so forth? Doctor says yes, signs it, sends it back, that's submitted to the arbitrator. That's all they need to do to prove that case. Or they simply call him to testify by telephone, which is allowed under the arbitration rules. But the point is, they have to have that testimony anyway. Plaintiff has to prove the injury by the testimony of a medical professional anyway. So they've got to be there either written or some form of oral testimony to say, yeah, I think this accident caused this injury, or I think this fall caused this injury. So they're there already. Just two other points. The problem with not having the plaintiff have to prove any of these things, except to submit a document to the court and say, these are what the medical bills are, is that we don't, under that circumstance, we're never going to get the chance to question the doctor about those bills, potentially. The doctor that generated those bills, we may not question them about it. What I mean by that is, until a doctor testifies for the plaintiff, as you may know, we don't get to go speak with the doctors at all. We don't get to, under Oregon law, we don't get to go depose a doctor, find out what the doctor might say, or why the doctor did this treatment, or why the doctor generated this bill, or why this doctor's bill is 10 times the rate of what we know the regular bills from other doctors are for the same procedure. The second is, this has incredible implication based on a couple of cases that are working their way from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court right now. This case called White versus Jubitz, and I forget the name of the other case that's going on right now, but essentially what the case says is that if as a result of an injury, a plaintiff generates $100,000 in medical expenses. These are the bills that the hospital and the doctors all generate. And based on an agreement between the healthcare provider, the insurance company, or whatever, that medical expense of $100,000 is written off such that only $40,000 is ever paid to the medical providers. There's what we have considered a $60,000 write-off. under these cases that have been decided by the Court of Appeals, the plaintiff gets to claim the entire $100,000, even though they don't need to repay any of that money to the medical care providers based on their agreements, results in a $60,000 windfall to the plaintiff for monies that have not been actually charged or collected, but money that goes directly into the pockets of the plaintiff. And we never get to tell the jury about that. The jury will never know that, although they're awarding what they think are $100,000 in medical bills, 60 of that's just going to the plaintiff. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Questions? I have one question. And Greg, I think it's what you brought up, or maybe, I forget, either one of you brought up the thing about not being able to dispose, do depositions on the docs beforehand. You know, my thought was that if this went forward, that the defense could always subpoena the doctor as to going through that process. I understand that would shift the burden to that point. But I don't do this type of law. I just do the prosecution side. So what I'm hearing is that the statutes now prohibit the defense bar from having contact with the doctor to determine the validity of any claims that have been made by the plaintiff?
That's correct. Yeah, there are a couple of issues, and one is has to do with expert discovery under Oregon civil law. There's a patient-physician privilege. There's also the HIPAA, federal standards on disclosing healthcare information. So quite literally, we don't know until the first time that a doctor testifies. We can't go talk to them. There are very few occasions, and fewer judges are allowing us to do this anymore, and that is to go talk with a treating doctor about what did you perform, why did you do it, and potentially ask them, you know, why was the charge so much different here than it might be in a number of other cases.
So even though there's a claim that's been filed by the plaintiff, and they're seeking some type of recovery, you're prohibited from following through on that investigation.
Chair Brzezinski, that's exactly correct. Oregon law, the decisions have been that even though that the plaintiff has put that into issue, until they actually call the doctor, we don't get to go speak with them.
Right. And I understand the expert witness part. That's another area. All right, any other questions? All right, thank you all very much. The last two people I've scheduled on here for 309 at this time is Tom Holt and Courtney Dresser. 10:30.
Yeah. I don't know if we do it on time. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt here today on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. I'll be brief. I think you've heard from others some concerns that would be similar to ours. We met with the proponents of the bill on Friday and discussed problems, in particular the third paragraph that would appear to take away the ability to challenge the reasonableness and necessity of expenses. We've agreed to attempt to work on language to correct that and a couple of other minor areas of the bill in terms of having some, you know, a little more administrative ease of getting bills into the record. In principle, we don't have an objection with that and actually kind of like that idea, but this bill is a little more complex than the length of it would appear on its face, and so we're going to do a little work on that, and we've agreed to attempt to do that work.
All right, thank you very much. And Courtney.
Hi, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. We, too, have discussed at least one change we would like to see. There is a difference, and Mr. Hood explained it quite well. There's a difference between the expenses incurred and the actual charges. So we'd like to see some new language regarding that. So when he was talking about $100,000, but only $40,000 is actually paid or reimbursed to that provider, that $60,000, though, is still asked to be paid for in an award case, a damage case. So we're looking to just make sure that that doesn't occur, that they just pay out what they need to pay out, what they were paid.
Right.
Physicians are paid.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for either of our panelists? Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Just one quick question. How onerous is the requirement to authenticate bills on the part of the medical profession, on the part of the doctors?
I don't know if I have an answer for that. I would say that we do believe this bill is a step in the right direction if we can keep our providers in their healthcare arenas providing service to patients and not in a court. We would like to see that happen. We understand that in some cases they're going to have to come into court and justify or stipulate to bills, but I think it is a process that we like to see if it can be streamlined a bit and that they don't have to come into the court a lot to do that. We would be open to that. We just need to make sure we're talking about the right thing.
Follow-up. Just to clarify, is this usually done by telephone or is it usually done in a short deposition, or do the medical professionals actually have to travel to and attend court?
Zansky, Senator Whitson, if I may, ORS 4505 that's referenced in the bill provides a short list of means to authenticate, and some of those are fairly light lifts, for instance, providing a written documentation that, yes, this is a real bill.
All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 309? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 309, and I'm going to tell the parties in Senate Bill 306 and 309, the chair's looking at doing this, having a one-time group meeting, kind of a little work group. Chair will be part of that group, and I'll have counsel with me. We'll look for a time that we can put an hour aside and see if we can't work through some of the, let's say, differences of opinions on those two bills, and see if we can't come to some agreement. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. That's why I'm saying, giving everyone fair warning, we're looking at one meeting. We'll put down some proposals, get some responses to it, and if we can work through it, so be it. If not, then we'll see what the committee wants to do. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing. This is on Senate Bill 277, and we'll do that now. And then for the other two bills, council will make contact with those who we want to have engaged, and it's basically going to be the principles that were here today. So thank you. All right, so council, if you can give us an overview on 277.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 277 requires a place of public accommodation to allow a customer with an eligible medical condition to use the toilet facility under certain conditions. It shields that public accommodation from liability for use of the facilities. Violations are a Class D violation with a $90 fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have, looks like, four people have scheduled to give testimony today. And it looks like, is it Beth Cook and then Jason Cook? Why don't y'all two come up first, and then we'll bring up the other two after that.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Beth Cook. Thank you for hearing me today in support of SB 277. I'm a parent with two children with incurable gastrointestinal diseases. I have a 12-year-old daughter, Haley, who has celiac disease, and my son, Jason, who is here with me today to testify and advocate for SB 277. I've experienced raising two children who must learn to deal with the indignities of having what we call bathroom diseases, diseases that our society doesn't openly discuss because of the embarrassing stigmas placed on those bodily functions, adversely affected by Crohn's, colitis, and other gastrointestinal diseases like celiac. Widely talked about or not, these diseases do exist and are life-changing. Simple pleasures like going on a shopping trip become less enjoyable with the shadow of a possible emergency need for a restroom. As a parent, at times I felt like I was a member of a military reconnaissance team, scoping out where every bathroom was just in case we had an emergency need to hit a restroom. I've tried my best to help my children understand their diseases and to cope with the unpleasant experiences they both have had while undergoing so many tests and medical appointments to diagnose the diseases. I have watched their struggles to process loads of medical information and try to explain to their peers what it is they have and what they must do to remain healthy. I've listened to them as they've worked through processing that they are not like other kids and must deal with being different. I am proud that both of my children have taken as much control as they can to learn with their diagnosis, treatments, and to never, ever use their diseases as an excuse to slack off, either in school or in an athletic arena. But the reality of gastrointestinal distress can hit with a flash, and at that moment, when they're suddenly doubled over in pain and need a restroom immediately, the disease takes over, and that feeling of control is lost in fear and embarrassment and in pain. In conversations with many people about SB 277, most people's reaction are the same. Of course a business owner should and could open up and employ a restroom to someone who is in obvious gastrointestinal distress. But in my work as a volunteer with the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, I've met so many people who tell the story otherwise, even here in Oregon. While we shouldn't need to create a law to allow people with these diseases access to an employee restroom in an emergency, the unfortunate reality is that we do need this law, which helps protect the dignity of those who suffer from diseases that result in acute gastrointestinal distress. And we need SB 277 passed to help them cope with an emergency situation with a little bit of grace and a little bit of dignity. I strongly urge for you to vote for and support SB 277 and to send it to the floor for consideration. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
All right, thank you. Jason, we have your written testimony. What I'm going to ask you to do is to speak from your heart. Just tell us about your situation. We'll read this in its entirety later.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for hearing me speak today. I'm Jason Cook. I'm a high school senior. I've got the normal senior load of doing way too much. And on top of that, I have Crohn's disease. And I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 2005. I was a freshman. And I've learned over the years that Crohn's disease is not fun to have at all. I have had to deal with literally doubling over in pain in my intestines and having to rush to the bathroom out of class, out of swim practice, in the middle of meals. Admittedly, I've never been refused bathroom use at a public facility. Hopefully, I never will have to run into that, but the reality is that there are a lot of people that do have to deal with that with any kind of disease. And I know that I'm lucky. I'm pretty lucky. I only have to take pills four times a day, which sounds like a lot, but it's really not. And it's hard for a lot of more people. I have friends that can't eat lettuce or tomatoes or whatever because of the disease. I have friends that literally have to get up in the middle of meals every time they sit down to go to the bathroom. And for a while, I was like that too before I started getting treated. And I know that it would be extremely difficult for me to have to be refused going to the bathroom. I can't really picture it. It would hurt my pride a lot, and it's really very embarrassing. It's sometimes very difficult to talk about the disease because there is such a stigma on it. That's why I'm here to testify for SB 277, because I think that it's that important that it helps. It helps let these people know, with people who have Crohn's disease or other IBDs or other gastrointestinal diseases, that there is this care for them out there, that they don't need to suffer these indignities like Allie Baines did, who originally brought this in Illinois, or other people who have had to deal with this in Oregon. And more importantly than this is that it is raising awareness, and it's this fact that you don't need to be degraded. And knowing that is just, it helps me out, because I know that right now I'm stable, but at the same time, soon I might not be. It's a very fluctuating disease, and it could change any day. Now I'm actually in the midst of changing my medications. And I know that there could be the chance that I will run into the same problem as Allie Baines did, and I don't want to have to deal with that like she did, and I want other people to not have to deal with that. So that's why I'm here testifying in support of SB 277. I hope you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Any questions?
have a question. I just want to thank both of you for coming. I know sometimes it's hard to get away from, especially you being in school, Jason, but I want to thank you for coming and bringing this to our attention and telling your story. So I have a sister-in-law who has lived with Crohn's for more than a decade, so I'm very familiar with some of the challenges you have. But thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you all. Okay, the last two, I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher one of these names if I say it, so I'm not even going to try embarrass myself. And then
Yorkia and Gelatos.
Okay, great. Easy for you to say.
I don't like Gia, so that's a little easier.
Okay. So thank you all both for being here. Whoever would like to start off, just give us your name and then your statement.
Chair Przanski and the committee, thank you for hearing our testimonies today. My name is Gia Angelados, and I represent the Northwest Chapter of the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. CCFA's mission is to cure Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis and to improve the quality of life of patients affected by these inflammatory bowel diseases. CCFA supports Senate Bill 277, giving IBD patients as customers access to employee toilet facilities. Currently, over 1.4 million Americans live with some form of IBD, and that includes about 17,000 Oregonians. These diseases can oftentimes cause a patient to experience painful, unpredictably urgent bowel movements. A few seconds to a few minutes can be the difference between finding a restroom and having an embarrassing and degrading public experience. This law would give patients the precious seconds needed in these situations, decreasing their chances of a public accident. We at CCFA and patients with inflammatory bowel disease ask for your support of Senate Bill 277 and that you send it to the floor for consideration. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. And is it Mara?
Mara.
Mara, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Mara Addison, and I reside in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I am here in support of Senate Bill 277, the Restroom Access Act, commonly known as Alley's Law. My daughter Lauren was diagnosed at age 11 with ulcerative colitis. This is an IBD disease affecting the colon and causing sufferers to require...
I want to ask you to just speak from your heart. We've got your written testimony. We'll review it.
Okay.
So if you can just give us kind of a summary and how this has impacted your family.
I've watched my daughter suffer with the disease since age 11. She's 19 now. And about a year ago, when we were in Portland in a retail clothing establishment, she had an attack and she needed a bathroom immediately. It was evident. They denied her. And they asked us to, they said it's an employees-only restroom. And they said, please go down the steps, across the way, and up the steps. There's a store there that will allow you access. And that time, my daughter did make it to the bathroom. But my question is, what about the next time and the time after that? Allie Bain in Illinois, I've given you the states where it's passed. It's passed, the Restroom Access Act has passed in 8 states. It's pending in 11. And Allie Bain was not as fortunate as my daughter. She had an accident in a clothing establishment where she was denied access and a very humiliating, negative experience. But she took that experience, brought it to her state legislatures, and it was passed as the Restroom Access Act, commonly known as Alley's Law. And that's why I'm here today. So these patients, along with other medical conditions that need restroom access, do not experience what Allie experienced. And I thank you for hearing me today.
Well, thank you. First, for committee members, there are a couple questions I'm going to throw out there, but I know we're at our time, so if you have other appointments starting at 10, feel free to leave if you like. Senator Bonamici?
Thank you. You may be asking this question. I just want to make sure. Apparently, according to the testimony, written testimony, the patients will have some sort of card or something so that it can't just be anybody who says, okay, I need to use your bathroom because I have inflammatory problems.
Right. So. It's a card that briefly explains the situation so that they don't have to stand there and
they will
talk
get
to the employee.
From their physician? Or from the association, or where do they get the card?
There is actually a nonprofit organization. I think it's called myibd.org. My daughter got the card. Okay. And also the Crohn's Colitis.
We do offer a card that says a similar thing. It just, you can provide it now, but it's not a law that they have to let you use the restroom.
Right. Well, that's exactly my line of questioning, was basically from the perspective of an employer who didn't want to see their closed facility becoming used as a open public facility, what are the checks and balances?
And so the card, and the way it's issued, is it just based on request, or do you require some type of documentation to demonstrate that they have the symptoms or the disease?
Well, from CCFA, it's a card with, it says, I can't wait. So it's not from a doctor. It's from the patients who have joined
the organization. It's part of our organization.
Mm-hmm. And with myibd.org, it's also a card that says I have a medical condition, or they can get a doctor's note and carry it in their wallet.
Okay.
So as it stands right now, someone without IBD could join the organization and get a card. I don't see any abuse happening with that, but it is possible.
I believe the law requires a card to show the shopkeeper.
Right.
That there is truly, so there is no abuse of a bathroom.
Yeah, ours isn't drafted that way. We can always do that, but for me, I think for the committee, we want to kind of just know, you know, the pros and the cons, as well as what are the checks and balances for this. Clearly, the chair's believes there's a reason to go forward, but we want to make certain that we don't set up unintended consequences. And specifically, you know, when you think in some of the larger metro areas where you may have individuals who are just wanting to use the facilities just for convenience as compared to necessity.
Mm-hmm. No, they do need to present a card.
Right. Okay. Then any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. And Jason, thank you again for coming forward and being willing to share your life experiences with us. So is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 277? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And Council, I think that takes care of us for today.
That does take care.
And we'll adjourn. Thank you.